From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one judge's perspective on what's wrong with the criminal justice system. Judge Harold Rothwax has served on the New York State Supreme Court for the past 25 years. He's developed such a hardline reputation, he's sometimes called the Prince of Darkness. But he began his career as a defense attorney and a liberal. He was vice chairperson of the New York Civil Liberties Union. He now has a controversial new memoir called Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. Also, commentator Gerald Early has some thoughts on Louis Farrakhan's recent tour of Middle Eastern and African countries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has approved a bill tightening U.S. sanctions against Cuba. It comes 10 days after Cuban fighter planes shot down two U.S. civilian planes. The House is expected to take up the measure tomorrow. President Clinton strongly supports the bill. The legislation discourages foreign investment in Cuba and urges the president to seek an international embargo against the country. It also makes the current economic embargo against Cuba a law instead of an executive order. It also prevents any president from lifting the embargo without congressional approval. Israel has rejected a conditional truce offer by the Islamic group Hamas. Israeli soldiers have now begun sealing the family homes of suicide bombers and tightening restrictions on Arabs. Meanwhile, President Clinton is offering Israel new help to combat any further violence, UPI's Bill Small reports.
In a speech to the National Association of Counties, Mr. Clinton described a series of steps he's taken to help Israel ward off future terrorist attacks.
These steps include immediate emergency transfer to Israel of highly sophisticated detection equipment, the dispatch of American specialists to work with their Israeli counterparts on strengthening anti-terrorism measures.
In addition, Mr. Clinton said there'll be a package of training, technical assistance, and equipment to help improve coordination among governments in the region and diplomatic pressure on other governments to support anti-terrorism efforts and the Mideast peace process. Bill Small at the White House.
Embattled Utah Congresswoman Enid Waldholz has announced she won't seek re-election to her seat. The first-term Republican has been the subject of heated criticism about the mishandling of her campaign and personal finances. Waldholz has blamed her finance problems on her estranged husband, but today she says she cannot properly clear her name and represent the people of Utah at the same time. Waldholz has refused to resign her seat despite pressure from those who say she got it through illegal campaign financing. Snow and sleet have become factors in several of today's primaries in New England. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Radio reports.
The advice for voters in Maine, Vermont, and parts of Massachusetts was go to the polls early, as a storm has been making driving increasingly difficult through the day. The weather is expected to keep voter turnout light in northern New England. Bob Dole is considered the front-runner across the region, although in Maine he's facing a tough challenge from Pat Buchanan. Observers say Buchanan could benefit from the foul weather. His supporters are seen as extremely loyal and willing to turn out no matter what the conditions. The only presidential candidate making an Election Day push in New England is Indiana Senator Richard Lugar. Lugar hopes good showings in Maine and Vermont will revitalize his sagging campaign, but few here think he'll get them. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Portland, Maine.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen nearly 3 points to 5,603. Trading is heavy. This is NPR News. Testimony continues in a hearing for deposed Panamanian President Manuel Noriega. His attorney claims he's entitled to a new trial because federal prosecutors used underhanded ways to get testimony from senior members of the Cali and Medellin drug cartels. One prosecutor took the stand this morning. Two cartel informants testified yesterday about payments to a key prosecution witness. A propane fire continues to burn at the site of a train derailment in east-central Wisconsin. That means the 1,700 residents of Wyawega will spend another night in emergency shelters. Gil Halston of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The risk of the explosion has diminished at the site of the 37-car train derailment in Wyawega. National Guard Lieutenant Tim Donovan flew over the site by helicopter at 10:30 this morning. He says at least six of the derailed cars are still burning. There are 14 propane tanker cars on the train. Four have already burned out. But officials are also worried about two cars carrying sodium hydroxide solution. The Northern Central Limited Railroad has set up a clearinghouse to help find housing in local hotels for evacuated town residents at the company's expense. Officials at a command post 2 miles from the scene say emergency cleanup crews will not return to the site to assess damage until 12 hours after the fire is completely out, and that could take 3 days. For National Public Radio, I'm Gil Halstead in Wausau, Wisconsin.
Ford Motor Company says it expects to cut the number of people it needs who develop new vehicles. Ford says it's trying to simplify its product line. The New York Times reports Ford plans to cut 6,000 jobs from the product development plant, which now employs nearly 30,000 people. Ford won't confirm the story. A spokesman says any cuts would involve contract workers and no layoffs would be involved. The number two automaker wants to trim the number of vehicle platforms around the world. A platform is the basic architecture of a car or truck. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Judge Harold Rothwax has the reputation of being tough. So tough, some lawyers refer to him as the Prince of Darkness. He's particularly unpopular with defense lawyers. But Judge Rothwax used to be a defense lawyer and a liberal. In fact, he's the former vice chairperson of the New York Civil Liberties Union and former senior trial attorney with the Legal Aid Society. For the past 25 years, he's been a judge on the New York State Supreme Court. In his new book, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice, Judge Rothwax says it's time to rethink the system's current principles and practices and see if we deserve better. For example, he says he's tired of watching lawyers knowingly pervert the truth to win a case. He's tired of watching criminals go free on technicalities. I asked if his perspective changed when he changed from defense lawyer to judge.
Well, I think your perspective changes a great deal. I don't think that your principles necessarily change. When you're a defense lawyer, obviously you have a single-minded devotion to your client, and your purpose and goal is to do everything that you can for him within the bounds of law. When you become a judge, obviously your perspective becomes more widely attuned, and you're concerned not only with defendants' rights, as you are, but also with victims' rights and with the fair and efficient administration of the criminal justice system. So I think the perspective does change, but I think that the principles can remain the same.
Now, you say that in a court of law, truth is sometimes subordinate or even irrelevant in the way that a case is argued, and that we need to reevaluate the role of the defense attorney. What are some of the things that you think defense attorneys typically do that we should start challenging?
Well, I think defense attorneys are obliged to move to suppress truthful evidence if they can, under the law, do so. So I don't attack them for doing what is, in effect, the nature of their job. What I do complain about is that our system has given them so many opportunities to challenge the truth. In a way, what we have become is too ready to suppress the truth. And over the last 30 years, I think what's happened is that more and more we're devising legal principles that permit defense attorneys to suppress the truth. If we permit them to do that, then they have every obligation to do that, and I don't criticize them for doing it. But I do criticize the law that now permits, in New York, for example, 20 to 30 motions to suppress evidence. This evidence is often highly reliable and probative, often dispositive of a defendant's guilt, and it seems to me that we're encrusting the system with too many procedures and principles and precedents that allow us to suppress the truth and impair and impede and obstruct the ability of the courts to arrive at the truth.
As a defense attorney, how would you feel about defending somebody who you knew was guilty?
Well, you know, I always divided that in my own mind. As a defense attorney, I felt, again, that it's proper to put the people to their proof. And that if you don't have a system where the people's proof is challenged, then a system becomes sloppy and it may become abusive as well. So as a lawyer, I felt that I was performing a function that was necessary to the proper functioning of the system. As a citizen, it would bother me sometimes. And you can distinguish that role. As a matter of fact, and parenthetically, I've had a number of defense lawyers come up privately and tell me that they've enjoyed the book enormously and agree with most of it, but that publicly their lips were sealed and they could never say that kind of a thing, but that as fathers and husbands and sons, they very much agreed with the need to make our system a more efficient system, a system that pays more attention to the truth. So I think defense lawyers commonly divide their role between their role as a defense lawyer and their role as a citizen. And they may feel differently in different roles.
Give me a sense of how you'd like to change the ethical guidelines governing the behavior of defense attorneys when they really suspect or know that their client is guilty.
Let me say that I don't really think that's the problem, if you'll permit me to re-identify the problem.
Please.
Okay. The problem as I perceive it is not with defense lawyers who zealously represent their clients within the bounds of law. The problem is with defense lawyers who use excessive zeal and go beyond the rules of law, go outside of the bounds, and do it with some frequency. And the reason why that is a major problem now is because there is no agency in our society, not the defense attorney himself, not the bar associations to which he belongs, not the courts themselves. There is simply no agency now that is restraining those defense attorneys, so that increasingly the heroes in the defense bar are those who go beyond the bounds, who push the envelope.
Give me an example.
Well, I mean, where a lawyer will do something that he knows to be improper. So I'll give you a simple example and a clear one from the O.J. Simpson case. In that case, I turned on the TV one day and I heard Judge Ito saying to one of the lawyers, "That's the 13th time I've told you not to ask that question." And the first thing that occurs to me is, why wasn't one time enough? Why, when the lawyer was told the first time, "Don't ask that question again, it's an improper question," didn't he have an internal disciplinary mechanism that says, "I will not ask that question again"? Why, when he asked it the second time, didn't the judge quickly put a stop to that? Why, when he was told 13 times not to ask that question, didn't a bar association censure him or remind him that this was improper and incorrect behavior on his part? And it's all too typical now that whatever you can get away with. I later spoke to that lawyer and I said, "Why did you keep on asking the question when the judge had told you repeatedly that it was an improper question?" And he said, simply, unapologetically, "Because I could."
What would you have done if you were the judge in the O.J. case and a lawyer was continuing to ask a question you told him
well,
you couldn't
ask? Well,
as
luck would have it, I had that same lawyer in front of me and on another case. And when he started to do the same thing, I said, "If you ask that question again, I will assume you have no good questions to ask, and I will terminate your examination." And that was the end of the problem. So in a way, I guess, judges get the lawyers they deserve. If they don't allow lawyers to misbehave, the lawyers don't misbehave. Why do judges behave passively? Partly because that's their role definition in the Anglo-American criminal justice system. They have been bred to passivity, and the lawyers increasingly have a central and dominant role. Also because the judges are up for reappointment or reelection, and bar associations play an active role in that, so they don't want to make enemies unnecessarily.
You know, defense attorneys always say when they're accused of going too far, "Well, doesn't my client deserve the best defense?"
I couldn't agree more. His client or her client does deserve the very best defense within the law. Again, my argument is not with zealous representation, but either with insufficient zeal, which is a major problem, or with excessive zeal, which is also a major problem.
My guest is Judge Harold Rothwax. He's a judge on the New York State Supreme Court and the author of the new book, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. Now, you said that about 90 to 95% of all cases are plea bargained. Is that of all cases that you see or in general?
Oh, I think that's probably true all across the nation, although it's certainly true of my experience here in New York over the past 25 years.
Well, are there practical reasons why?
Oh, yes. First of all, we have an enormous volume of cases, so you begin with that. Secondly, we have constructed and devised an extraordinarily complex and protracted criminal procedure, which makes it very difficult to process a case from point one to conclusion. And so that volume and that complexity conspires to make it impossible for us to afford trials to all of the people who enter the system. Indeed, in my classes at the Columbia Law School, I point out to my students that more cases enter the system in 1 week in New York than we have the trial capacity to try in a year. And that obviously puts enormous pressure on the courts to plea bargain. And that's true, as I say, throughout the country.
You have a controversial approach to plea bargaining.
Yes, I do.
What you do is you offer a limited window of opportunity in which the defendant can cop a plea. It might be 15 minutes. It might be 2 hours. Tell us about your approach.
Well, I don't fully accept your description of it, but I certainly can tell you about the approach.
Okay.
Let me explain, first of all, what the philosophy behind plea bargaining is. What plea bargaining is. Plea bargaining is the giving of an inducement to a defendant, in effect a discount to a defendant, to plead guilty so that he will not burden the system. In effect, what we do in plea bargaining is give a defendant less than he would otherwise normally and rightly deserve if we didn't have to concern ourselves with extraneous factors that don't relate to his guilt. So I have to be concerned with whether parts are available and judges are available and a great many other factors that don't relate to what the proper sentence would be. And in order to get him to plead guilty, I basically offer him a sentence less than he deserves. Now, I may not know whether he's guilty or not, but basically the defendant initiates this process. He comes forward and he says, through his lawyer, what kind of a deal, what kind of a promise, what kind of a sentence will you offer me if I plead guilty? His lawyer will come up and say, what is the offer in this case? Judge, make us an offer in this matter. So in the plea bargaining context, what we do is assume the guilt of the defendant. We assume not only his guilt, but his readiness to plead guilt, provided that he gets the sentence that he thinks is appropriate and one that he can live with. So we work on that assumption. We begin with the fact that the defendant is guilty. Now, the purpose of plea bargaining is to provide promptness and certainty and finality to a system that is otherwise sorely lacking in those qualities. So, in my situation, what I do is I say, I'm going to give you my best offer first. In other words, I'm going to give you the best offer you're ever going to get in this case at the very outset, because I don't want you to feel that there's any advantage to you in holding out in the process. I want to make it clear to you that it will be to your advantage to dispose of the matter early on if you're guilty. And if you don't dispose of it early on, I will increase the offer. So in a situation, I might say in one particular case that the offered plea in this matter would be a sentence of 2 to 6 years. And if you don't take the 2 to 6 years, as you're free not to do that, you're free to do it or don't do it, but you continue to litigate as you have every right to do, then the offer will become less attractive. So if you're ever going to plead guilty, it's better for you to plead guilty now rather than later. If you plead guilty the next time, for example, the offer may go up to 3 to 9. The proper sentence in this case may have been 4 to 8 or 5 to 15, something like that. So I will raise the offer if the fellow continues to litigate. He has every right to litigate, but to me he doesn't have the right to get the discount for not litigating if he litigates.
Now, does that put unfair pressure on the defendant to plead guilty very quickly?
Puts pressure on a defendant to make up his mind. All of life is decision-making. It seems to me not making a decision is a decision. If you can't make up your mind whether to get off the first stop or the second stop on the subway, and while you're making up your mind the door closes, then in effect you've made up your mind to get off at the second stop. So in a sense, we are all forced to make decisions in our lives. I was forced to choose whether to go to law school or medical school, you to go into journalism or retail selling. I mean, we're all forced to do that. Is there anything inappropriate with it? No, I don't think so. So long as I'm satisfied that the defendant is properly advised, that he's been given the necessary information to make an informed decision, he has a lawyer who can assist him in that, and he's been given the time to consider that.
Do you think your approach of strict time limits is effective in fulfilling the mission that you want to accomplish?
I think strict time limits are good so long as the time limits are adequate to afford the person an opportunity to make up his mind. Now, sometimes 15 minutes is sufficient, and sometimes 15 minutes is not sufficient. It's important to understand that before a case gets to me, it's been in the system anywhere from 4 weeks to 2 months. And he's had lawyers during that period of time. He's gotten a discovery material during that period of time. So he's had time to think about this. I've also taken into account what kind of a criminal record he has. If he's an extensive prior criminal history, he's been around the system, he knows how it operates. It would be very different, for example, if I was dealing with a 16 or 17-year-old youngster for whom this represented his first arrest, who would need time to confer with his parents and so on. So you distinguish between the defendants you were dealing with. You would distinguish the level of evidence against the particular defendant. Some defendants have very strong cases against them. Other cases are much more litigable. So there are a number of factors that you would consider in determining how much time a defendant should reasonably be able to have in order to properly make up his mind with regard to that offered plea.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Judge Harold Rothwax. He's a New York State Supreme Court judge and author of the new book, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. Judge, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Judge Harold Rothwax, New York State Supreme Court Justice and author of the new book, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. Now, it's my impression from your book that there's times when you think, when you're first approached in a case, that that the defense attorney is being absurdly optimistic in arguing on behalf of their client's innocence, that their client is so guilty and everybody's just kind of playing a game of overlooking this.
Well, there are times when games are played. This is a very game-playing kind of a field that we live in. The lawyer knows most often that most of the time the person he's representing is guilty. The system is constructed that way. So
is that true? You think most of the time?
Of course, yes, without any question. I've just been reading Alan Dershowitz's new book. He says exactly the same thing. And let me explain to you why that's so, and why that should be a consolation to you in a democratic society. You should know, for example, that every time a person is arrested and brought before the court, the first thing that the judge asks is there probable cause to believe that this man committed the crime? If the answer is yes, he moves the case along within the system toward trial. If the answer is no, he dismisses the case. Therefore, every case that comes to trial has been repeatedly found to be guilty by the judges who've reviewed it. Everybody who goes to trial has been found to be probably guilty by the time the case goes to trial. And wouldn't you want it just that way? You wouldn't want people to be picked up for whom there was no probability of guilt. You wouldn't want screening procedures not to be in place. It would be morally monstrous for us to be bringing people to trial for whom there was no reason to believe that they were probably guilty. So it's one of the great consolations of a democracy that's not disputed either by liberals like Alan Dershowitz or anybody else who's informed that overwhelmingly most of the people who were brought to trial are guilty. And therefore, it is the role of the defense lawyer, if possible, to suppress evidence where he can, to mislead, to distort, to confuse, to manipulate. And Dershowitz himself describes that in his most recent book. There's nothing radical about it. Although people not fully familiar with the way the system operates seem to react with shock when that kind of a thing is said.
So getting back to when you think a defense attorney is presenting his or her defendant as innocent when you feel quite confident that the person's guilty, what do you do?
Well, he has every right to say, in every case that comes before me, I say to the defense lawyer, is there a possibility that we can dispose of this case? That is, are you interested in exploring the possibility of a plea bargain? If the answer is yes, then we explore it. If the answer is no, as it sometimes is, where the defense lawyer says, no, judge, this case has to be tried, then there is no plea bargaining, and we just move the case along the track to trial. Now, even if I believe on my review of the evidence that it's likely that the fellow has committed the crime, that it seems highly likely that he's guilty of the crime, there may be a number of good reasons why he doesn't want to plead guilty. It may well be that it's a very serious crime, and he knows that if he pled guilty, he'd get life imprisonment, so he feels he might as well try the case. It may well be that he's a professional person, and if he pleads guilty, he'll lose his professional license as well as go to jail, so he feels obliged to try the case. So the fact that a person goes to trial doesn't mean that he has any belief in his innocence or even any belief in the likelihood that he'll be acquitted, but that there is no attractive alternative to that process. So if a person wants the trial, I try to give him a trial as speedily as possible and to give him a fair trial. He's entitled to a fair trial. And if he's convicted, then I'll sentence him appropriately. And if he isn't, and he's acquitted, then we'll bid him goodbye and he'll go on with his life.
Now, your area of specialization is search and seizure. You want to change the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule is the rule that throws out evidence that is obtained through an illegal search. What aspect of the exclusionary rule would you like to change?
Well, I want to change its mandatory aspect. Right now, what we have is a mandatory exclusionary rule, and it's probably worth noting that we only are the only democracy in the world that has a mandatory exclusionary rule. There's no other democracy, whether in Western Europe or in the British Commonwealth or the Scandinavian countries, that have a mandatory exclusionary rule. They have a discretionary exclusionary rule. The other thing
I would... What's the difference?
Between mandatory and discretionary exclusionary rules?
Yeah.
The difference is that under a mandatory exclusionary rule, whenever the court finds that the police officer has either acted wrongfully or made a good faith mistake, the evidence must be suppressed. Regardless of how serious the crime may be, regardless of how minor the police infraction may be, the evidence must be suppressed and the defendant will often be released. In most other countries, they don't do that. They will look at whether or not the police officer's infraction was willful and intentional, or whether it was a good faith blunder or mistake. They will look at the serious nature of the crime in determining whether or not the criminal ought to go free or the evidence ought to be introduced. They'll bring a certain level of proportionality into the process, which we reject. I don't know if you're familiar, Terry, with the case some weeks ago in which Judge Baer in federal court suppressed 80 pounds of heroin and cocaine up on the Washington Heights area of New York City. In that kind of a case, there was a big furor. The politicians screamed about it. And in effect, what they were doing was complaining about the fact that an admitted drug dealer and distributor who was very heavily involved in the drug trade, large quantities of drugs being involved, was released because a policeman had either not made a mistake and the judge was wrong, or because if the police had made a mistake, it was what appeared to be a good faith minor mistake. And there was no proportionality that a major drug dealer should go free because a police officer made a minor mistake. Many years ago, back in the 1930s, Judge Cardozo said it seems foolish to release a criminal because a constable has blundered. And it is foolish. So I think it's also clear that when you take proportionality out of the law, you take justice out of the law. You take reasonableness out of the law. And our mandatory exclusionary rule rejects any consideration of proportionality.
Judge Harold Rothwax is the author of the new memoir, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. He's been a New York State Supreme Court Justice for the past 25 years. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Judge Harold Rothwax continues his inventory of what's wrong with the criminal justice system. We'll look at Miranda, jury selection, and more. And commentator Gerald Early has some thoughts about Louis Farrakhan's recent tour of Middle Eastern and African countries. ¶¶ This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Judge Harold Rothwax. He's been a New York State Supreme Court Justice for the past 25 years, and before that was a defense attorney. He's written a new book called Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. When we left off, he was explaining why he thinks it's time to change the exclusionary rule that makes evidence obtained in illegal searches inadmissible. He says since the exclusionary rule is mandatory and not discretionary, it's applied no matter how serious the crime and how minor or accidental the police infraction. We need proportionality, he says. He illustrates his point with the case of Daryl Nicholson, which Judge Rothwax presided over in 1993.
Daryl Nicholson was spotted by a number of anti-crime police officers. Anti-crime police officers are police officers who drive in plain clothes and in unmarked cars. And they were investigating in an area where there had been a great many livery car robberies. And as luck would have it, they pulled in behind, at a red light, behind the livery cab and noticed Nicholson, who was a passenger in the livery cab. Nicholson turned around and stared at them. And they thought there was something suspicious about his behavior, that the average cab passenger might look around but would not stare at the people behind him. And they decided to follow the livery cab briefly. The light changed, and they did follow the livery cab for a few blocks until it stopped while waiting to make a turn. And again, the defendant, Nicholson, looked at them and stared at them for a long period of time, then bent over in his seat. That is a sign to an officer that they may be trying to get rid of contraband or a weapon, and then sat up again and again stared at them for a long period of time. So they thought it would be advisable or desirable to pull this fellow over to make sure that nothing bad was up, and they had been trained. The sergeant in charge there had been an anti-crime police officer for about 12 years. So they put on their little hood light, and the cab pulled over. As soon as the cab stopped, Nicholson fled from the cab. He was immediately arrested or stopped by the police officers, and a loaded 9mm pistol was recovered from the cab. It turned out that Nicholson was a persistent violent felony offender. That is, he had a number of prior violent felonies in his past, and if he'd been convicted of this weapon, he would have had to have been sentenced to life imprisonment.
You had to rule on whether the police stopping this cab constituted a legal search or not.
That's right.
What was your dilemma in ruling on that?
Well, what my dilemma was that it seemed to me that the police officers had acted properly, that they seemed intelligent, they seemed alert. They were aware of the precinct condition involving many livery cab drivers. They acted in a restrained fashion. All they did was ask the cab driver to pull over. The cab driver was probably very happy that he had done so. And they may have saved the cab driver's life. And so all in all, it seemed to me this was an example of good police work. And yet, under the law as it existed, I was required to find that they had did not have a sufficient basis for pulling over the cab, because under New York law, furtive conduct by a passenger in a cab is not sufficient basis to stop the cab. I think that's a bad law, but as a judge, I'm required to apply it, and so I was required to suppress the weapon and to dismiss the case against Daryl Nicholson. It's clear that Daryl Nicholson was probably going to either rob or murder that cab driver. And it's clear that by releasing him, we have released an extremely dangerous man back into the community. But the search and seizure law required that I do so.
Well, how often in your experience do you think the search and seizure law protects the citizen against overzealous or corrupt police? And how often do you think it actually hurts the citizen because it means that the guilty go free? I mean, there is a balance here that we're looking for.
Well, I want to make it clear that I'm not in any way criticizing the underlying core values of the Fourth Amendment, the amendment that deals with search and seizure. I couldn't agree with you more that the police should obey the law while they enforce it, that we have always to be concerned with limits on abusive police conduct. I think that the exclusionary rule does not do that. It does not further those goals. I mean, and the way in which the Supreme Court imposed it on the states back in 1961, because it was not a requirement in the states before that time, was hasty and impulsive and without careful consideration. It seems to me that it doesn't serve its purposes, and by imposing the exclusionary rule, What we have done, in effect, is to obstruct and block the search for other effective remedies. You can have criminal prosecution, you can have police discipline, you can have civil suits, as we saw in the Rodney King case, and so on. There are many other ways in which you can do this, and you can even use the exclusionary rule selectively, with discretion, rather than mandatorily. So I'm not opposed to the underlying values or the concerns that people properly have in a democracy that police must be restrained in the performance of their task. What I'm complaining about is the irrational and excessive way that we've gone about that. That's my real concern.
Now, you're a judge on the New York State Supreme Court. I believe Governor Pataki, the governor of New York, wants to loosen search and seizure laws. Do you agree with the approach he supports?
Well, I frankly think that the way Governor Pataki is going about it, it will not pass muster. I don't think he can do that by legislation. I think this rule can only be changed by the U.S. Supreme Court or the highest courts of the states themselves. Since this is a matter of constitutional interpretation, the legislature cannot control what the U.S. Supreme Court does in that manner. So although I agree with the purpose of what Governor Pataki is trying to do, I don't believe that the way he's trying to do it will ultimately be successful.
One of the things you would like to reform is the Miranda rule. Then this is the rule that requires police to read a suspect his or her rights before getting any information from them. Did I explain that correctly?
Well, yeah. Basically, the Miranda decision held that if a police officer takes a person into custody and wishes to interrogate him, that he must give him certain warnings, that he has a right to remain silent, that if he says anything, it may be used against him, that he has a right to counsel, and that if he cannot afford counsel, counsel will be made available to him. Those are the Miranda warnings.
And everybody knows about Miranda through cop shows, if nothing else.
Right, right.
So what's your problem with Miranda?
Oh, let me count the ways, Terry. how do we begin with this? First of all, I guess, generally speaking, it's probably a good idea to note that, again, we are the only democracy in the world that encourages suspects not to talk. Not Western Europe again, not the British Commonwealth, not the Scandinavian nations, and all of those countries, democracies, free nations, they don't encourage their persons not to talk. They encourage them to talk. Now, the Fifth Amendment reads, and again, I have, just like I had no underlying problem with the Fourth Amendment, I have no underlying problem with the core values of the Fifth Amendment, but the Fifth Amendment reads that no person in any criminal case shall be compelled to incriminate himself. And I agree with that fully. We should not be threatening people. We should not be beating them. We should not be depriving them of sleep or food or holding them for long periods without an opportunity to meet with people and so on. All of those things, all of those values, I agree with. The Miranda ruling does not deal with that, in effect. Indeed, before Miranda, for the 30 years prior to Miranda, the Supreme Court had been engaged in a process of dealing with what the police could do and what they couldn't do during the process of police interrogation. That had been their concern. And during that 30-year period, they had devised certain rules for the police and standards for the police that they had to abide by in questioning suspects. Miranda went well beyond that. And Miranda held, I think improperly as a matter of constitutional law, but also improperly as a matter of policy, that even if a statement was voluntary, even if it had not been compelled, the statement could still be excluded because the warnings had not been given. There was no requirement of warnings in the Constitution. And for most of our history as a free nation until 1966 when Miranda was decided, warnings were not required by the U.S. Supreme Court. This was a creation of the Warren Court in 1966. And what it means is that we no longer focus on whether the statement is voluntary or whether it was compelled, which is the proper concern under the Fifth Amendment, but we focus on whether or not the warnings were given. Let me give you an example of the kind of formalism and absurdity that Miranda leads us into, if you have a moment. There was the Ferro case in New York. Ferro was a fellow who, with an accomplice, went into an apartment and was burglarizing the apartment. The female occupant came in. They murdered the woman. And he and his accomplice stole all the furs from the apartment. Ferro was shortly thereafter arrested, and he was brought to the precinct, and he was given his Miranda warnings, told he had a right to remain silent. He said, "Oh, I do. Thank you. I choose to remain silent. I won't say anything." And they put him in a nearby cell while they did the paperwork necessary to bring him to court. While that was going on, Ferro's accomplice had been caught, and the furs were obtained from him. And the police started bringing in the furs into the squad room where the police officer was working and where Farrow could see the furs as they were placed on the floor. When Farrow saw the furs, he immediately started to confess and said, "I killed this woman, and can I cut a deal, and can you help me," and so on. There was no question but that what Farrow said was completely voluntary. Indeed, you probably couldn't have stopped him, because once he saw the furs, he realized the evidence against him was strong. Farrow went to trial, and he was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment, and the case was reversed on appeal because of Miranda. And what they held was that when Farrow said he wanted to remain silent, the police had to stop their questioning. And when they brought in the furs and put them on the floor, that was indirectly questioning him. They couldn't do it directly, and so they chose to do it indirectly, and as a result, Farrow went free. Now, it seems to me that is foolish in the extreme. We've gotten away from the Fifth Amendment, which focused on the issue of whether or not the statement was voluntary or whether it was compelled, and we're now involved with all kinds of formalism.
But you know the argument on the other side, or one of the arguments on the other side, is, okay, sometimes a guilty person goes free, but isn't that the price we pay for making sure that the innocent person isn't sentenced, or that someone's rights aren't violated?
But
in the
all of these situations about which I'm complaining, in the Miranda case and in the Fourth Amendment area, search and seizure area, what's happened is not that innocent people are being convicted, but that guilty people, whose guilt cannot be disputed or reasonably argued, are going free. And if you look at it for a moment more, just look at what they say, because in a way it's a distortion. There is no right to remain silent under our Constitution. The right is that the society cannot compel you to incriminate yourself. You cannot be compelled to incriminate yourself. In effect, what they do in Miranda is urge a person to remain silent. There's no other democracy in the world that does that. And there is a far cry between coercing a defendant and urging him to remain silent. One could just as well say you have a right to remain silent, but you also have a right to talk. And as a citizen of our community who may have committed a serious crime, one might even argue that you have a moral obligation, a responsibility to redeem yourself, to return to the community, to come forward and tell us what you know about this crime. There's something about the Miranda warnings that in a way says this ought to be a sporting contest, that the defendant ought to be put on the same level as the police, and the police should not be able to thoroughly and effectively investigate.
My guest is New York State Supreme Court Justice Harold Rothwax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Judge Harold Rothwax. He's written a new book called Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. Now, I want to get to another issue that you talk about in your new book, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. And this is the right to not testify in your own trial. Now, you don't challenge the right to not testify, but, you know, the jury is not supposed to make any inference.
Let me explain that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Under the law right now in the United States, if a defendant, such as O.J. Simpson, mm-hmm. chooses not to testify, the judge is required to instruct the jury that the jury may draw no adverse inference from the fact that he has not testified. And I disagree with that. And you should know, and your listeners should know, that until 1965, that was not the rule. Until 1965, the judge could say that in a situation where a defendant reasonably can be understood by the jury to know about certain facts, and in the trial of his case he's being given an opportunity to deny or explain those facts, and he chooses not to deny or explain, then you may draw an adverse inference from that. That was changed only in 1965, after 170 or 180 years of our constitutional jurisprudence, and then it was only changed by a 5-4 verdict, a 5-4 vote. And it seems to me that that was an improper decision, and you can properly draw an adverse inference. Here is Simpson in an open courtroom. We're not now talking about beating a person incommunicado in a police station late at night when he's all alone. Simpson is sitting in a courtroom for 9 months. He's surrounded by 10 lawyers. The world is watching. There's a court reporter. There's a judge. There's no issue of beating. 90 witnesses come forward and testify. They apparently have no right to remain silent. They can be obliged to come into court, be subpoenaed, be required to testify. They have no right to remain silent. They are required to testify. Now we turn to Simpson. After the judge has said, I find that the evidence is sufficient, if believed by the jury, to warrant a conviction in this case, they turn to Simpson, and Simpson says, I don't want to say anything. And I don't even have any problem with that, because I don't want to compel him to say anything. But it seems to me that the jury should not be denied their right to draw rational and reasonable and common sense conclusions in a situation where a person has an opportunity to deny or explain and declines to do so. And we permit that, by the way, in civil cases. England now permits it in criminal cases and has remained a democracy by all the latest accounts.
Now, juries, you have a lot to say about juries in your new book, Guilty. And you talk about how you think juries are making some bad decisions now in a lot of celebrated cases. I think you'd include the O.J. Simpson jury in that.
Sure.
The jury on the Rodney King case, you'd include on that.
A whole bunch of them, yeah.
I guess one of the things that interested me most about your argument here is that you're saying that you think sometimes jurors are intentionally chosen to not be very bright because
sure.
If the defense thinks that their client is probably guilty, then the defense is better off choosing witnesses who won't be able to intelligently weigh the evidence.
Sure. Seems logical and natural. If you're representing a person whom you know to be guilty or strongly believe to be guilty, and you know from discovery that the evidence against him is strong, and that if that evidence is properly evaluated, your client will be found guilty, it would seem to me the defense attorney would be obliged to try to pick jurors who could not intelligently evaluate the evidence, who would be emotional, manipulable, suggestible, who would be swayed by rhetorical devices and so on. And I see it every day in my courtroom, where the large number of peremptory challenges is used by defense attorneys to what I call dumb down a jury.
Give me an example.
Well, I had a case. I had a funny case a while back. A woman is charged with an $800,000 Medicaid fraud. A lot of computer records, a lot of mathematical computations, all the rest of that. The jury is in the courtroom, and as luck would have it, among the prospective jurors are a math teacher, a financial officer of a corporation, and an accountant. And they're all intelligent. They seem sane. They seem fair-minded. They seem fine. They seem like just the kind of jurors you'd want in just this kind of case. But, of course, they're all challenged by the defense attorney, who says, I don't want these people. They're too qualified. By that, he means they'll understand the evidence. They'll be able to see this clearly and evaluate it properly. So he gets rid of them. There's nothing wrong with them. The only thing that's wrong with them is that they'll see what is, in fact, the case, that she's guilty, and they'll find his client guilty. So he gets rid of them.
On what grounds?
He has peremptory challenges. He doesn't have to give any grounds. I mean, one of my recommendations is that we reduce the number of peremptory challenges to 3. England has already done away with the peremptory challenge precisely for this reason, to do away with this kind of conduct. And I would favor either reducing it to 3 or abolishing it altogether. But I think the problem here, again, is that the peremptory challenges are being used to dumb down the jury.
Something else you'd like to change. Instead of a jury verdict having to be unanimous, you'd like to see a 10-2 or an 11-1 vote hold.
Yeah, again, it's been my experience that in those situations where there is an overwhelming majority, 10-2 or 11-1 for conviction, in my experience both as a lawyer and as a judge, almost invariably the one or two holdouts are irrational, emotional, stubborn, obdurate, unwilling to engage in deliberations and so on. And the effect is that you, by requiring unanimity, give them a power of juror nullification. And I think that's a real concern. And you force, in effect, a compromise verdict which detracts from the truthful verdict which they might otherwise bring in.
What do you think of TV cameras in the courtroom?
I'm in favor of them.
Why?
Because I think it's the only way the American public will ever learn about what's going on in our courtrooms. Right now, they're left to movies and TV fiction, and it seems to me that distorts and misleads people about the way the system actually operates.
Of course, some people say that the presence of the camera distorts what happens in the courtroom.
It does when you have immature judges and immature lawyers. It doesn't when you have mature people. And if you have immature judges and immature lawyers, it's probably a good idea to find out about it soon.
I'm sure you count yourself as mature.
I do. I had no problem with it in the Steinberg case.
Uh-huh. So did you have to do anything different in that case?
Absolutely not. The camera became a piece of furniture. The lawyers did their jobs professionally. People ignored the camera and forgot about it. It just was a piece of furniture in the room.
I have one last question for you. What do you think about the formality of the judge's costume, you know, the robe? Is that a useful thing for you?
Yes. I mean, some people have protested that the robe is a badge of elitism or a mark of elitism, and I've always viewed it very differently. I feel that when I put on that robe, it's a reminder to me that I am now an embodiment of the law, and I am not free to do anything I please, but I am obliged to apply the law with intellectual honesty and compassion. And so to me, I think lawyers should wear robes, to tell you the truth. That would reduce and diminish their individualism and indicate and remind them that they are members of a profession that have certain disciplinary standards that they should adhere to.
Judge Rothwax, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
New York State Supreme Court Justice Harold Rothwax is the author of the new book, Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice. Coming up, commentator Gerald Early on Louis Farrakhan's recent tour of African and Middle Eastern countries. This is Fresh Air. Louis Farrakhan, the head of the Nation of Islam, recently returned from his tour of African and Middle Eastern countries. His trip included meetings with the heads of state of Libya, the Sudan, Iran, Nigeria, and Iraq. Supporters praised him for expanding the spirit of the Million Man March. Critics condemned him for meeting with dictators who have violated the human rights of their citizens and exported terrorism. Commentator Gerald Early has these thoughts on how Farrakhan's trip fits into the larger history of African-American interest in foreign affairs.
That Louis Farrakhan should cast a blind eye to the fact that he was visiting and endorsing countries run by cruel despots who terribly mistreat their citizens is not surprising. Part of his legitimacy for his followers, and for many black folk generally, is that he is received by heads of state as if he were a head of state. This gives many black Americans the feeling that they are indeed a country within a country, instead of merely a minority group. He is further validated by some blacks because many of the countries that received him have hostile relations with the United States. This demonstrates to his followers that he is fearless and does not care if he is censored in the United States for cavorting with the enemy. He shows that the enemies of the United States are the friends of black Americans because the United States is, to his view, the enemy of all people of color. To Mr. Farrakhan's mind, the United States is, after all, the world's most powerful white nation. Now, Mr. Farrakhan's junket is nothing new in black America. African Americans have always been interested in foreign affairs. They have tried, in various substantial and symbolic ways, to gain leverage for themselves in the United States by connecting themselves to other countries. Malcolm X traveled abroad meeting heads of state when he was both a member of the Nation of Islam and when he departed that organization. Martin Luther King was in Ghana in 1957 during its independence celebration as a special guest of Nkrumah. He was in India in 1959 studying Gandhiism. King later called the civil rights movement a black zeitgeist, a harbinger of things to come. W.E.B. Du Bois held a series of Pan-African conferences approximately every 2 years, starting in 1919, trying to overthrow colonialism. In the 1920s, Marcus Garvey wanted to create a black world empire equivalent to the white world empire. There are still other ways blacks connected themselves to foreign affairs. African Americans demanded that the United States support Ethiopia when it was invaded by Italy in 1935. A group of blacks fought against Franco during the Spanish Civil War. A small but important number of African Americans, including Elijah Muhammad, the first major leader of the Nation of Islam, were persecuted during World War II for being Japanese sympathizers. They saw Japan as a colored nation fighting against whites for domination in the Pacific. There are two reasons for this international sense among blacks. First, blacks have never been permitted to feel completely a part of this country, so many have searched for another spiritual homeland. Second, other American ethnic groups, most notably the Irish, the Chinese, and the Jews, have been involved in foreign affairs for the benefit of their groups. Why not blacks? The push to end apartheid in South Africa was the African Americans' great moment of success in foreign affairs. Farrakhan's audience with Nelson Mandela was important for many mainstream blacks who so intensely identified with the South African victory. But does Farrakhan's other audiences help alter American foreign policy for the better towards sub-Saharan Africa? Definitely not. And it is time that African American leaders grow up and understand that a tyrant is a tyrant, no matter his skin color or his religion.
Gerald Early directs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting the 3-CD box set People Get Ready, The Curtis Mayfield Story, highlighting work with the Impressions and as a solo artist. This is NPR, National Public Radio.